Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Starting tonight, Mount Auburn Cemetery will host a reunion of sorts. Patrick Gabrich, the producing artistic director for Plays in Place, is the former artist in residence of Mount Auburn at Mount Auburn Cemetery. And while in that role, he wrote Moonlight Abolitionists. It is a play featuring six of the abolitionists who are buried there. That production will be performed in the cemetery over the next three nights under the full moon.
And what's fun about this play is not just what they're talking about, but where and how it's happening. So this play is staged as a concert reading, which means the actors are at music stands and they have scripts with them, but they're in the dark. This is an outdoor play intended to be staged under the full moon, written very specifically for that. So they have lights on their music stands, but it's kind of dark and you're out in the cemetery at night. And this setup of the play is such that they're kind of meet under every full moon and kind of retell their stories as a way of kind of keeping from fading completely into the shadows. And I was really thinking about, you know, what does it make us think about? What is it like when you're out in the cemetery under the full moon? You know, some people could kind of feel like, oh, being in a cemetery at night can be a little scary. And it is if you think in terms of cemeteries as like horror movie kind of things, but it's a very peaceful, serene place with birds and insect sounds, just whether it's daytime or nighttime. And that sense of it pervades even under the full moon. So it has this really special place. And I wanted to take advantage of that and then really get a sense of these people gathering and this kind of conjuring in a way.
Patrick was inspired to write the play when he stumbled across a monument dedicated to Charles Turner Torrey, and he decided to learn more.
He is someone who was kind of not a success as a minister. He'd lost a couple jobs because he was too obsessed with abolition, trying to be a reporter, but wanted to take direct action. So partnered with a black partner, Thomas Smallwood, who was born into slavery, freed himself at age 30 by buying his freedom. And they decided to start helping slaves escape. And this is not what abolitionists did. You know, they would help people who had already escaped, but they didn't encourage them. They weren't sure the morality of that, actually, which is fascinating to me. So, and they didn't want to just do it one at a time. They wanted to hurt the institution of slavery. So they would take a wagon full of people who were enslaved, 8, 10, 12 people at a time. They managed to free, in the period of about 2 years, somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 slaves, which is just astonishing. Harriet Tubman, who's probably kind of one of the most influential people we know about in the Underground Railway movement, freed about 80 in her lifetime.
Now, so much of Patrick's work is inspired by and a celebration of place, the place, Mount Auburn Cemetery. So we wanted to revisit part of a conversation that Radio Boston's Chris Siderick had with Gabrich in Mount Auburn Cemetery back in 2019 when he was showcasing the nature plays.
Well, I was down here before knocking water off the chairs and like five frogs just jumped in the water.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, got a lot of company out here. And the other day we were doing a show. There was a hawk, Cooper's hawk, eating its lunch over there, and the chipmunks are just going crazy around here. They're deep, 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 putting out the alarm call all throughout our place. That's crazy.
It's an incredible place here. I'd lived in the city for a long time, never really came down to check it out.
I think that's one of the big pluses of doing this kind of work and why my company, Plays in Place, is so interested in getting involved with working with museums and historic sites. Because we saw that with Blood on the Snow when we did the show over at the Old State House, and that's right downtown. And I talked to people who'd be like, I've lived here my whole life, and I didn't even know you could go inside.
Yeah.
And they're like,
and it's
yeah.
huge. I mean, you just can wander
yeah.
around and,
yeah,
and get lost here.
Yeah, and it's so beautiful, and it's free and open to just come on in, but it's the history and the nature. It's a world-class arboretum, so it has got so many things going for it, which made it a really difficult project to write about.
Yeah, I mean, that after the plays last night, I kind of took the long way out and just kind of wandered around a little bit, and I stumbled across the Longfellow family mm-hmm. Tombstones, and there's so many people buried here, the Gardner family, you've got... multiple Supreme Court justices, So when you decide, okay, I want to tell some stories about this place and the people and really try to capture it, some of your plays, you have a play about salamanders, a play about mushrooms, trees. How did you land on the themes that you ended up deciding to write about?
Exactly. Yeah, I spent a whole year trying to figure out what are the things we're going to write about. But it became clear quickly that they're kind of the two main strengths are the history and the resonance, but also the natural environment. And there, the institution here is really dedicated to that. So they have like a wildlife manager, and there's so many staff members that are involved in maintaining this place. And I really wanted to get to that heart of things. And so some things made sense right away because the bird watchers are a big presence here in the spring. So I went to 6:30 in the morning bird walks, and I had already been a bit of a birder, but trying to understand kind of what the culture is around that. That's the other thing about writing plays in the cemetery is anytime you're writing plays, you're writing about people. So even salamanders aren't really about salamanders. Right. It's about people and how they interact and how we're dealing with a world that is sometimes frightening and changing, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, so we're standing at the spot where the salamander play takes place, the first of the five plays. And, I mean, you're surrounded by these beautiful purple flowers and Consecration Dell, and as the salamanders refer to it. In the play, you have two salamanders who meet up for the first time and are exploring this potential mating ritual. And we've got a little bit of tape of that, so we'll listen to that here.
I'm not sure if I'm going to lay eggs this season.
Oh, come on! What did I do now? I said all the right things and I meant them. You've got my heart pounding so fast it's making me dizzy.
It's not you, it's the world. I don't think it's fair to bring babies into this world.
But we can try.
I was really struck by there's humor in the play, but there's also this theme of two people trying to explore modern dating, and also this fear of bringing children into a scary world. I'm a father of two young kids, and to me that really was a powerful moment. I think it's a question that a lot of people are grappling with right now. How are you thinking about that as you wrote that play?
You know, you start from some point, and I had been talking to people about the salamanders that are here and how they're kind of rare, and their mating habits are a little unusual. So I was kind of curious about that. But then once you start thinking about all the implications of what does it make to make new creatures and how do we all relate to the world, that just kind of led that way. And I think I'm interested in those big questions. But I want plays that are first engaging people, so the humor and drama that you are, and then allows us to ask big questions later.
So let's maybe walk to the next spot.
Go to Namesakes. One of the challenges I think for radio is that I wish people could see what we see today. You couldn't recreate this in a theater, and that's one thing I love about being outside, is that we can have a backdrop that allows us to explore things both thematically and also just the visually that we can have, that we don't have to create it. It's there.
Professor Agassiz.
Professor Gray, this is exactly how I expected to find you.
My curiosity for the world cannot be quenched.
A quality we share. I brought you something.
What is it?
If I told you, it would spoil your fun.
You were always perceptive. Not always correct, but certainly perceptive.
There's a long list of areas in which my perceptions were valued. Glaciers, fossils, fish, to name but a few.
Louis Agassiz is a pretty controversial figure. There are some revelations about research he's done and things he did during his career that have raised some serious questions about his legacy. Can you talk a little bit about what those concerns are?
Right. So the biggest issue with him is he has a very troubling racial history of his views. An argument that we made is his views are not different for the time. There are plenty of racists in the mid-19th century and today. I think what is especially troubling about him is that, one, he is particularly repulsed by people of color and wrote about it to his family in letters, but also wrote articles and essays that were then used to support slavery going forward through the mid-1800s.
Right. So you're asking some really important questions here that I think we're grappling with as a society right now in terms of legacy and whether things that bear names of people who have come and gone, how we should see those names. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how you were thinking about that as you're putting this together?
This kind of came about by accident in that I had talked to the staff here and like asking, you know, if I'm writing these nature plays, like who are the naturalists that I might want to write about? And Asa Gray and Louis Agassiz came up right away. And then trying to understand what's their argument about. Is it about, you know, is it about evolution? In a scientific argument that already feels settled, right? But then I started just doing basic research. I'm like, wow, there's a lot of things named for these guys. And how does that feel? And then I remembered the Maria Baldwin School renaming. I'm like, oh, how does Louis Agassiz feel about that?
Headstones are one thing. But I have streets, an entire neighborhood, schools.
Ah, the school. Is that what this is all about?
Once a thing has a name, it should not be changed. We shouldn't look up in the sky at night and say, oh, there's Mars. No, wait, that's the god of war. Let's rename it something more peaceful.
And because these are men in the 19th century who had a great amount of ego tied up into things being named. That was a big part of the 19th century, of classifying things and naming things. So what does it feel like when we get to that moment where the present has making different decisions?
And there was this kind of fascinating question that the actors asked the audience basically at the end of that play. The widow says he was a good man, and one of the other characters says, was he? And there's no real answer to that. This is a real person with real challenges who did real research that advanced science in some ways, but also resulted in some pretty concerning events.
As a society, right this minute, we're dealing with some big questions around the naming of things, whether it's Civil War monuments or things around Louis Agassiz and people with troubling racist past or who are great misogynists. And we're being forced to confront, as other generations have before us. It's not unique to us. You know, when something has a name, how long does it get to have that name? Is something named after it forever? Or what does it mean in the present when we now know something about the person it was named after, if it's named after a person? You can't unknow that. So when once you know something that is now brought to you in the present, you have to make a decision. So something can be named something for a long time, and maybe it's just inertia. It doesn't matter. But once you know something, your society has now made a choice. We either keep it, and that says something about it, or we say, there are plenty of other things to name people to name a school after. Let's make a different choice. And it's a consensus. And so it's not easy. And there's big arguments. And this play definitely, well, I've already had big arguments about this with people.
I want to ask you quickly about a line that jumped out of the, I think it was the fourth play, the play about the birds or the bird watchers. One of your characters says, I'm just out in the world trying to pay attention. And when I do, it makes sense. I found that really powerful because I think there is a real power in nature and in going back to nature as a species. Can you talk a little bit about that connection with the natural world?
I feel that way very much myself. And I think that play was channeling a lot of how I feel being here out in the world and thinking about just like even going on the nature walks with the birders or the mushroom guys and just like taking the time to realize that we're part of a greater whole and just to slow down for a second and pay attention around you suddenly changes the whole vibe in this world. Our modern world can be so frenetic and feel scary and we don't know what to make of it. And sometimes you just need to look at your feet and there's a mushroom there and like, oh, okay, things are growing and there's a whole cycle that's going on.
And you end with a play that really is a pretty emotional play. The main characters are trees, and then you have one mourner who comes into the cemetery. I was really struck by the line, life in the aftermath, in the sense that that's kind of what a cemetery is all about. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about kind of balancing people who come to a place like this. A lot of times are here for a sad reason. They're mourning and actively thinking about someone they've lost. And yet there is a sense of kind of hope and positivity. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
I think that sense of life in the aftermath is exactly what made Mount Auburn Cemetery unique in 1831 when it was founded, in that there was no institution like this at all. People were buried in church graveyards that were not at all inviting, not a place you'd want to spend time. And so there was a sanitary reason for creating this, but there was a whole new movement around transcendentalism and a notion of man's relationship to nature and also to death. And this place brought a new way to deal with that life in the aftermath. And that is a continuing thing, a continuing theme that stays with this place. And is it, the whole design of it, is it intended to get you engaged with losing yourself a little and seeing life around you?
That was Patrick Gaybridge, producing artistic director for Plays in Place, a theater company focused on site-specific productions. He was talking with Radio Boston's Chris Siderick about one of his earlier works, The Nature Plays, back in May of 2019, which was an eternity ago, before the pandemic and before our nation's reckoning on race. Now, Gaybridge tells us that tonight's play, Moonlight Abolitionists, may feature folks who have long since passed, but still ask plenty of relevant questions about our current moment.
It feels like we're at a moment where people have very strong convictions about social and moral issues in America right now. And I think it is useful to look at historical figures who are faced with some of the most important and difficult moral and political challenges of our history. And that's definitely the men and women involved in the abolition movement. And to understand what it took for them to take action that wasn't always popular, that wasn't always easy. And I think this play asks a question, you know, somewhat indirectly, but also maybe somewhat directly of, you know, what are you willing to do? What are you willing to sacrifice for something that you feel is that important? And that these were real people, and sometimes they failed, and sometimes they were weak, and sometimes they didn't do enough. And that's all part of their story too. I always say my role in writing historical drama, which I do a lot, is kind of to unflatten history, to take out these historical figures and say, look, it wasn't easy for them either. And it's okay if it's not easy for you. They didn't know all the answers, and we don't have to know all the answers either.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to Radio Boston.